Our guest is Celeste Ng, best known for her novel Little Fires Everywhere, a family drama set in Celeste's own hometown, the upscale suburb of Shaker Heights, Ohio. The book was a major bestseller. It was later adapted for TV, starring Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington. Celeste's first book was Everything I Never Told You, and it took 6 years to come to fruition. It was also a New York Times bestseller. Celeste now has out a new book, Our Missing Hearts, set in a dystopian but chillingly realistic United States of America, where a political and economic crisis has led to anti-Asian racism and violence and a heavy suppression of any unpatriotic behaviour. It brings to mind history, and it brings to mind fears also for how close such dystopian futures can be. At its centre is a 12-year-old Chinese-American boy named Bird and his mother Margaret, whose poetry has become a rallying cry to protest new racist legislation. Celeste Ng is with us. It's a real pleasure, and congratulations on another book. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's really a pleasure.
Could you explain a little more to listeners the pretext and the setting for the new book, please, Celeste?
Our Missing Hearts is really the story of a family. It's about a 12-year-old boy named Bird, as you said, and he's been growing up with just his father. His mother has left the family, and he doesn't know very much about her other than that she was a poet. And at the beginning of the book, he gets a letter from her, a sort of mysterious letter that's actually just a drawing of lots of cats. And he's drawn into a quest to try and find her, to understand why she left the family, why she's gone away, and sort of what's going to become of their family.
There's almost, it's a dystopian thriller. There's almost a sense of the same kind of menace that one feels with Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, not quite as graphic by any means. It's more subtle. It is the psychological control of a population. And could you just explain a little bit more about the America that it is set in and how it got there, Celeste?
Yeah, I wanted to write a book that wasn't in a, you know, a dramatically transformed world. I wanted it to be recognizable to us. So in the world that Bird is growing up in, I call it, you know, our world maybe just 5 degrees off of where we are, or our world one track over. There's been an economic crisis, and one of the ways that the country's come out of it is by finding a scapegoat, and that scapegoat is China. And so there's a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment, and there have been new laws passed that require everyone to be patriotic and to report anything that seems unpatriotic. And if you're seen as being unpatriotic, your children can be taken away. And so this law often gets applied to people who are of Asian origin or anybody who kind of stands up against them. And that's the atmosphere that Bird's growing up in.
There are so many things that, as you have eloquently described, are just 5% away from where we feel we could be in any country. But this is set in the contemporary United States. Do the patriotic thing, dob in someone you suspect, even children, that these things are done to protect us, that the existence of the Preserving American Culture and Traditions Act, or PACT, is about protecting us. Again, the language is the conduit of the control.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's this sense that what the law actually says is very reasonable. It says that you shouldn't say things that are against your country. It says that you should report anything that seems like it might be a threat. But of course, we can see, as you're saying, that that's actually a way of kind of controlling people, because that's a very subjective measure. What is against our country? Is criticizing unpatriotic? You know, that's kind of the question that people are asking themselves. And it's certainly something that we've been talking about over here in the real world.
And the economic implications are there as well in Bird's, and Bird doesn't get to use his name either in school. He goes back to being Noah as part of all this story. Bird was the name he coined for himself. I won't give too much more away, Celeste, just the little hints. But in his education, his maths examples are if a car is made in China and a car is made in the United States and one lasts longer or whatever. Everything is at this almost subliminal level. And it really often does feel just 5% away. You would have been writing this, one imagines, or at least forming it in your mind, during the tenure of former President Trump. Did this start as a result of some of what was happening at that time, or were you already writing it and perhaps it was influenced by some of what happened?
I started off really with it as a family story, and it was when we had the 2016 election and we saw kind of the rise of the far right and the kind of hatred that it brought. That was really when a lot of the elements started to come into the story, especially the parts of the story that look at anti-Asian racism. But I think a lot of those ideas had been brewing in me for some time. I'm a Chinese American woman, and I think I've long been aware of the ways that it sometimes feels like my presence here or my acceptance is conditional. It's fine for me to be considered American as long as I'm doing and saying the right things, sort of heavily in quotes. And I realized those were questions that I'd been thinking about, and it felt like the right moment to write them as we were living through the last presidency.
Part of this dystopian world, although as we said, one that's not too hard to imagine, is the banning of books that encourage sympathies towards Asian populations. Now, is this actually already happening in some context, Celeste?
I don't know for sure about the Asian part, but we are starting to see a lot more of banning of books that are seen as being political or seen as being... unpatriotic isn't exactly the word that's being used over here, but for example, books that have to do with LGBTQ issues, or books that want to look at our nation's history of slavery of Black people. Those are books that a lot of groups right now, or certain groups, I should say, are really trying to keep out of public circulation. And that's quite a scary thing to me. It means that we won't learn about the past, and then we won't be able to stop making those mistakes in the future.
Books, stories, and libraries as a sanctuary, as a place of refuge, but also as a place of free thought, play a huge role in your book. Of course, there's the book about the cats and the cat drawings, which is a delightful theme here. And I won't elaborate on its link into the core plot. There's also Noah, or Bird's father, Ethan, a former linguist, who's now demoted to stacking library shelves, but whose intellect and knowledge infuses the writing beautifully. And this is another really important message, the library and books as a representation of free thought, often ironically diminished or destroyed in the name of some kind of freedom or patriotism, yeah?
Yeah, the book is really a love letter to libraries, to storytelling, and to just sort of the written word, the ways that people try to tell each other about their experiences. As you say, Bird starts looking for his mother, and one of the places he finds help and he finds answers is in the library. His father works in a library, ironically, as you say, a lot of the books have been removed in the name of, you know, sort of public safety. But it's a way in which the characters start to recognize why holding on to those stories and keeping them and making them available is important, and what you stand to lose if those stories get removed.
In the book, we see the separation of children from so-called dissident parents. You'd actually written this before, I think, we saw some of the tragic stories at the US-Mexico border, the separation of children, and often long periods of times when authorities couldn't reunite families. And having written of this and then seeing it in a different context, but again in the United States of America, what were your thoughts?
It was a very scary feeling. As you say, I had started to write a story in which I realized the consequence of you know, speaking out was that you might be separated from your child. That came from a personal place. I'm a parent myself, and that's one of the most terrifying things that I can imagine. And so I was already writing the story in which the threat of having your child removed would be a cudgel to keep people in place. And then in the news, we began to see stories of the separations of families at the US-Mexico border. It was one of those moments where fiction and reality had kind of veered towards each other. But of course, that's because this has happened before in history. It's not something that I imagined or that's just made up in a book. It's happened many times in the past, and it may keep happening again unless we decide to change it and think about it. That's kind of what I hope the book will do.
It's one of the most important messages is the scapegoating, and we have seen this repeatedly in history, and it happens often at times of crisis. It happens at times of economic crisis where someone has to be to blame, it seems, in the human psyche, for things that are going wrong for others. A pandemic is devastatingly upsetting to people's sense of security over their lives, and now we're dealing with the economic aftermath. And again, is this book extremely timely, Celeste?
Yeah, it's one of the places where I hope that the book would become farther away from reality rather than closer. But I think it's, as you say, it's a human instinct. We want to look for someone to blame rather than to kind of look inwards and figure out how we can solve the problems. It's always easier if the problem is outside. I think one of the things that helped me in writing this book was that I was feeling very downcast about how all of the things in the world felt like they were falling apart. And one of the things that pulled me into the story was, how do we find hope? I wanted these characters to be still looking for ways that they could try and make the world better, that they could find connection. And that actually helped me in writing the book. It gives me a little bit of hope that maybe we can get through this situation in real life too.
And that there are heroes, and that those heroes will resist, and they will find ways to resist, even in oppressive environments, and not just resist, but inspire.
Absolutely. I was asking myself a lot, you know, what can art do? As a writer, I was feeling a little helpless during the pandemic, especially because I'm thinking, if I were a doctor, I could be doing much more. And here I am writing stories. But I think that ultimately art is one of the things that can inspire us. Like you say, it can inspire us to take action. It can inspire us to try and connect with other people. And hopefully it can be one of the things that gives us hope for the future. You know, even in small ways, every little bit we do, I think, is part of not giving up.
Celeste Ng is our guest, the author of her latest book, Our Missing Hearts, also of two earlier best-selling books, one of which is very well known now as a TV series many of you will be familiar with, as well as the bestseller, Little Fires Everywhere. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. The first book was Everything I Never Told You. 19 past 10 it is. You have a talent for exploring the intricacies and tensions of family dynamics, often through the eyes of a young person. And in the case of the latest novel, it's Bird, or Noah, in Our Missing Hearts. You seem very able to put yourself well into the experience, I guess, of adolescence with Little Fires Everywhere, It's Pearl and Isabel and the siblings and the famous / notorious Richardson family. And just, are adolescent characters a particularly good vehicle for storytelling of the kind that you want to do?
I think they're particularly attractive to me as the centers of the story, because it's such a crucial age. It's an age at which you're just starting to tiptoe into adulthood. You're starting to have capabilities to get into quite a bit of trouble, actually, and to do things that will really impact your life. But you don't always have all the context to understand what's going on. I think of Bird's story in this book, he's 12, as him venturing out into the wider world. He leaves home for the first time. He starts to become aware of the world around him. And he starts to get the context to understand not only what happened to his family, but who he is. I think that's why adolescence is so interesting, because it's that moment where the camera lens of your life is kind of opening up just a little bit for the first time.
Of course, the other, Lydia, of course, and her siblings and Everything I Never Told You, another example in each book of a character of this age as an important storyteller. The second book, Little Fires Everywhere, as we said, a major hit and converted into a TV show. But the creation of these characters, I mean, one thing's fascinating is the setting. I found myself reading all about the Shakers, because Shaker Heights in Ohio, where you grew up, is the setting for the book. And what an interesting history it had as well. Just explain perhaps place in this instance as the start of a family story and indeed a community story.
Exactly. I learned a lot about the Shakers while I was writing the book, even though the book is not specifically about them. I think that history always informs the place that we're in, and then the place you live in informs who you become. Having grown up in Shaker Heights, I know it's a place that's always striving for perfection. And so when I started researching the Shakers who had originally lived there before the town was even founded, and learned that they were a utopian society, a lot of things started to make sense. And so for me, I think that place always helps to inform the character in the story, because where you live is always going to affect who you become, whether you mean it to or not.
There's such an interesting sort of sub-story here. You may find yourself, I don't know, writing another book entirely about them, because I'd heard of the Quakers, and they're similar to the Shakers in that it's this kind of religious, I suppose we'd call it a sect these days, but or a religious movement that are very demonstrative in their physical behaviours. But they were egalitarian. Women were sort of elevated to equivalent positions. That's not always the case in religious movements, Celeste.
Yes. Exactly. And they were fascinating. The more I learned about them, they were, as you said, they were fairly egalitarian. They always had two leaders, one of whom would be a man and one of whom would be a woman. They were essentially communist. When you joined the sect, you'd bring all of your worldly goods and contribute them to the group. But actually, if you wanted to leave, they would keep a careful written record. And if you decided to leave, they would give you back the value of what they brought in. There were all kinds of things about them that in some ways seemed almost ahead of their time. They were really fascinating. And as you say, someday maybe I'll get to use all that information I learned along the way.
However, this is a Shaker Heights that's a little bit more like the classic gated community, but it does allow others in inverted commas. But we just hide them, really. We design duplexes so that they look like grand homes and, you know, put everybody in the back. And who came first in this, really? The character of Elena Richardson is such a standout. She's such a catalyst for so much of this. But who were the characters who began to form first for you?
It was the entire Richardson family, actually. I tried to imagine, if Shaker Heights were a town, what might they look like? You know, how would that translate into the form of a family? And then immediately on the heels of that, I started thinking, and who would come in and kind of shake things up for them? And so very soon thereafter, Mia Warren, who's this artist from out of town, and her daughter came in. So they kind of sprang up almost as opposing forces to each other, on opposite pans of the balance, so to speak.
And whose lives and plot lines would become entwined, but there is a strong element of a battle of wills here. It's not necessarily just accidental happenings as this plot unfolds. The personalities, the character, the characteristics of your characters absolutely drive this.
Yes. In a lot of ways, I realize retrospectively that Mrs. Richardson, Elena, and Mia are both parts of me. I'm kind of an orderly person. I like there to be a system. I like to try to do my best, but I'm also a creative person. And those two impulses are always kind of poking at each other within me. And that's what these two characters do. They don't just sit side by side and look at each other. They're actively kind of needling each other. And that's what drives the story to its ultimate conclusion.
And again, we have these very important adolescent characters. Pearl, who is Mia's daughter, and Mia is saying, this time we're going to settle. This time I'm not going to move you on to my next, you know, personal project necessarily. But another character who absolutely captures one here is again the adolescent, and that is Izzy. And, you know, right from the start, Izzy is kind of being the other in this picture-perfect family, and it seems acceptable to treat her the way they do and to presume what they presume.
Yeah, they think of her as the black sheep in the family, and I think for her that's a really painful thing. The family doesn't realize that they're othering her, but she does. And so when she meets this other family who comes to town, Mia and her daughter, she starts to see, oh, this is a kinship here, even though we're not technically kin. And a lot of the story, I think, is about finding your kind of chosen family. If your family of birth doesn't see you for who you are, who do you find that can see you and reflect back who you actually are?
The adaptation to television, what was that process like for you? You were a producer. I guess there's two options. One is that you hand it over and leave it to someone else and cross your fingers. Another is that you get creatively very involved. And what was the process like for you?
For me, I wanted to be involved, but not in control. I said I wanted to be one of the voices at the table because I was very aware that film speaks a different language. It has a different rhythm. It needs to show things differently. And I knew that I didn't speak that language. And I wanted to work with people who did, the screenwriters, the showrunner. But I did want to make sure that the show was sort of keeping true to the heart of the original story. And so I got to read scripts and give feedback on ideas, but I very much wanted to let the other producers and the screenwriters shape the story into something new. For me, that was part of the fun of having an adaptation, is to get to see what other people do with the same material. And that was actually really a joy. I thought that they did an amazing job. And when they came to me and said, we're thinking about having Kerry Washington play the part of Mia, I knew then that I could trust them, that they were going to lean in and talk about the issues that I had been dealing with in the book, but just come at it from a different angle. It was honestly, it was really kind of a joy.
Look, you've had these three stellar, top-selling books, and what's the journey to getting there? Were there quite a few books that didn't make it? What's been your drive, your path, I guess, as a writer?
Honestly, my path has been very slow. I keep thinking, oh, maybe this time, I've written a book, maybe the second will be faster. I think it took me the same length of time. I thought, oh, maybe the third one will come faster, and it's actually taken me almost the same amount of time. I've started to accept that when I get an idea, it often gets its hooks into me, and I have to sit with it until I can see it through, and that might take a long time. But I'm recognizing that that's the kind of writer I am. I want to think about it. I want to let it develop. I want to really dive into it and try and do it justice.
There's been a sort of a method. You read English at Harvard, you did a Master of Fine Arts at the University of Michigan, wrote short stories for a time. But have you sort of learned, I guess, as a writer over time, that there's a limit sometimes to method, if not a writing method, to a career method?
There absolutely is. I have on paper a very traditional kind of method that used to be what, you were supposed to do as a writer, scare quotes or inverted commas. But actually, I don't think that's necessary. And I think it can only take you so far. You can do all those steps and yet still not come up with a book that is going to find its audience, or a book that satisfies you as an artist. And a lot of it has to do with luck, and a lot of it has to do with perseverance. I think when you have something that feels like a story that grabs you, sometimes you have to trust yourself. It's actually an act of faith rather than method at its heart.
Thank you, Celeste. Celeste Ng, the new book, as we said, or the latest anyway, Our Missing Hearts. It follows earlier publications. Little Fires Everywhere, in her first book, Everything I Never Told You.